Okay, well, good evening. By the way, that isn't my cell phone, so you can go ahead and call it. I won't answer it. Well, it's good to be here. This is actually my first time at OU, and I have sort of a history of hearing about you because I went to another small school here in Ohio, Miami University, and so I'm sure you're very nice people, but the only context I have for OU folks is the rivalry that we had, especially in football and basketball. So anyway, it's good to be here tonight, and it's interesting. I was thinking about tonight, and I did a talk like this, similar, little different topic, a couple months ago at Kent State, and when I got there, it was kind of funny. I realized I saw some of the flyers that they had posted outside about me coming in to speak, and it said at the bottom, you know, Dr. Paul Gould, and of course, I'm not a doctor. I'm a PhD student, and so I kind of had to clear it up right away and just sort of let them know where I'm coming from with that. And I guess I want to bring that up here, too, because even if I was, I'm almost done, but even if I was a doctor, I want to let you know the posture that I want to come to you today. And really the posture is this, is that, look, I'm on the same journey you are in life, and I'm trying to figure this thing out called life just like you are. And so I'd really like tonight just to be a conversation with each other and we're going to think about something that's an important topic, but let's just approach it from that perspective that we're going to address some important issues, but we're going to do it together. And actually, I did say to them, though, trying to figure out what to do with that, and so I said, I do have a master's in philosophy and theology, and so I said, well, you can't call me doctor yet, but you can call me master, so I guess you can call me master as well, too. Well, perhaps it's no accident that I'm here tonight as well, because if you think about it, we're on the cusp of one of America's most favorite holidays, right? We've got Valentine's Day in a couple days. And this is a holiday where we celebrate these deep and abiding relationships that we have with those with whom we love. And I think that that's important because at our core, each of you is relational, at the very core of who we are. And tonight, I want to suggest to you that we are relational at our core because we are created by a God who is relational at the core as well. So we're relational beings. But we're not just relational, are we, right? We're also rational beings. In fact, Aristotle calls us rational animals. And I want to suggest to you tonight that every one of us, every one of you actually desires to know. You desire to know the truth about reality, about ultimate questions, like whether God exists, or if he does exist, what is God like, the truth about yourself, and the truth about the world around us. So we desire to know. So we're relational, and we're rational. We desire to be known, and we desire to know. And I want to sort of put those two facts about us as fundamental datum about the human experience. Because tonight what I want to do is I want to consider two competing stories about what it means to be human. And sort of in the background as we're thinking about these two competing stories is the question, well, which story best accounts for these two sort of fundamental facts, that we're relational and that we're rational, that we want to be known and that we want to know. Okay? On one view, one story, which I'll call the naturalistic or the atheistic story, these facts are actually kind of hard to account for. It's difficult to make sense of things like rationality if we live in a deterministic world. And it's also difficult to make sense of relationships if all you are, is purely a physical being. And so things like love, emotions like love, are reduced to maybe chemical reactions in the brain and things like that. And relationships sort of get cashed out in terms of survival value, but that doesn't seem to do justice to the depth of intimacy that we long for as relational beings. On the other story, the theistic story, and the specifically Christian story, we're relational and we're rational at our core because God is relational and rational at his core, and he's created us like him. Okay, so here's kind of my game plan tonight. I'd actually love to do Q&A the whole time with you, but I've been asked to say something first, so we have something to talk about. So I want to do three things. First, I want to discuss in some detail these two competing stories about what it means to be human. And then, once we've sort of laid those out, I want to ask the question, which one's true? Do we have any good reasons to think that one or the other is true? And then finally, after that, and I want to argue that the Christian story is true and therefore the atheistic story is false. And then finally, briefly at the end, I want to just ask the question, well, what does this mean for you? And what does this mean for us, given the truth of Christianity? in the Christian story. So, okay. And the way that I want to go about this tonight, the way I want to describe these two competing views of what it means to be human is I actually want to call to your attention a metaphor. And the metaphor is going to be one of the home. And the reason why I want to use the metaphor of the home as sort of a foil to run this through is because I think that the home is actually something that deeply expresses, is one of the closest metaphors that we have for life, really. And let me explain that. And I guess the first part's obvious, that we all live in a home, right? And some of us don't live in ideal homes. Some of us, you might live in dorms. I don't know if it's ideal. It didn't sound like Scott's was the most ideal when he was here. But maybe it's off-campus housing, and they're not always ideal. In fact, when I was at Miami, the last 2 years at Miami, we lived in, it was just a bunch of guys, and let me tell you, our bathroom was not ideal. In fact, it was pretty bad, and so literally, when we got ready to clean that thing, which was once every semester, usually, we would arm ourselves with Lysol, and we would tie a rope around our waist, and somebody would get tossed in there, and usually about 3 minutes later, he'd be pulled out, lifeless. So, no, not really, but it was pretty bad. It was not ideal. And my guess is perhaps a lot of you come from homes that aren't ideal as well. Maybe you come from a broken home, or maybe it wasn't ideal in other ways. But here's the thing. I think that each of you have in your own hearts a picture of the ideal home. And I don't know what that would be for you. Maybe it's something like a Thomas Kincaid, you know, a nice wraparound porch with fireplaces in every room and a stream in the back or something like that. And so, more than just sort of the physical circumstances, home is a place where you belong, right? It's a place where you're known. It's a place where you experience intimacy with your family and your friends. That's the picture of an ideal home. But then think about this. Each day, we get up and we leave our homes, right? And we go to school, you hang out with friends, you do activities throughout the day. Always, at the end of the day, though, hopefully, usually, to return home. And so really, if you wanted to think of the rhythm of your life, it can really be summarized in four words. Home, away, and home again. Home, away, and home again. Okay, and I think that this is sort of the rhythm, the tenor, and the flow of our lives. And I think it's a good and a helpful metaphor. Okay, so with that sort of up there as a thought, let's look at these two competing stories. First, the atheistic story. And the first thing to notice about our home, given atheism, is that our world and our home actually turns out to be a cold, impersonal, and purposeless little speck of real estate of which we inhabit for a short amount of time in this sort of infinite sea of time. In fact, the atheistic creation story begins with five words, and that's, in the beginning, matter. In the beginning was matter. I should probably make sure there's five words there. In the beginning was matter. And these five words actually inform and give meaning to all the things that exist. So whether it's molecules or pulsars or animals, whatever it is, everything is material. So minds are reduced to brains. And like I said, emotions are reduced to C-fiber firings in the brain and things like that. And everything needs to be cashed out in terms of chemistry and physics. And that's basically the way that we understand the world, given naturalism or atheism. But further, we're told that science shows us that we live in a universe in which man does not have any special or privileged place of importance. In other words, there's nothing unique or significant about you or about your home. Let me share two examples, and I have a PowerPoint up here. Here's two scientists. The first quote that I want to share is by a guy named Steven Weinberg. He teaches at the University of Texas in Austin, and this is what he says. He says, "The human race has had to grow up a good deal in the last 500 years to confront the fact that we just don't count for much in the grand scheme of things." Then there's the astronomer Carl Sagan, and the quote that I'll put up from him, he shares it in the context of the Copernican revolution in which we need to, quote, overcome our imagined self-importance, the delusion that we have some privileged position in the universe. So this is the atheistic story, and basically what it says is that you're ordinary, that you're mediocre, and even worse, you're actually insignificant. Actually, though, what's interesting about these two quotes by Sagan and Weinberg is that neither of their comments are, strictly speaking, scientific statements. You notice that? Basically, they're statements that invoke the full authority of science to push forth their own favored creation story. And also, like I said, notice that on this story, man is ordinary. There's nothing special about you. So your home, our home, is cold, it's pointless, and everything eventually is doomed to die out. So on the atheistic story, we're simply witnessing today what I would call the abolition of man. In a deterministic world, we are losing, man no longer has freedom of the will, or rationality is hard to make sense of. In a materialistic world, we are being stripped of a soul and a mind and just being reduced to brains only. And then in a world without God, we're being stripped of purpose and destiny and dignity. There's nothing special about you. You were not designed, and you hold no intrinsic dignity because of that. And actually, I teach philosophy at Purdue, and one of my favorite atheists who I use all the time because he's so clear is a guy named Bertrand Russell. I don't know if you've heard of him. He wrote a book in the 1920s called Why I Am Not a Christian. Actually, though, in 1903, he wrote an article which I would really recommend. It was called A Free Man's Worship. And in it, he says something that I think is really insightful. He basically says, given atheism, given this picture of the world, all you can do is build your life on the firm foundation of unyielding despair. All you can do is build your life on the firm foundation of unyielding despair. And I think he's right, that if this is all there is no hope, and all you can do is build your life on despair. Okay, so that's one story, the naturalistic, the atheistic story. Let's talk a little bit about the Christian story. Now, I believe that the basic story of the Bible is of God creating a home for us and then giving us a purpose within that home. And in fact, early on in the first two books of Genesis, we read about God creating a place or a home. Then he creates a people, and then, of course, he gives the people a purpose. And it's interesting, after really early on, like Genesis chapter 3, we see man saying, you know what, I want to go my own way. I want to satisfy my own desires. And so you see from Genesis 3 to really the end of the Bible is a story of God wooing us back. And that's why I loved Scott's story, because it really was a story of God pursuing him relentlessly through the pain, through the angst that he was experiencing, because he knew that there's something more to life and that this isn't the way the world is supposed to be. And so you could really summarize from Genesis 3 to the end as a way and then home again. So really, you see the same metaphor. Home, Genesis 1 and 2, away, Genesis 3, and then home again as we read on. Okay, so what I want to do, though, is briefly describe for you what I take to be the establishment of the first home on the earth, and that's Genesis chapters 1 and 2. So, okay, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. Now, I actually read the first sentence there, and I get confused, especially as a philosopher, because I read about the heavens and the earth in verse 1, and then I read about that they were formless. And so I wonder right away, how can something like heaven that seems, or an earth that has form be formless? How can you have something that is both form and formless at the same time? That would be a problem if you want to be logically consistent. Well, let me suggest to you that a better or more accurate reading of the phrase formless and empty is that the earth was uninhabitable and uninhabited. The earth was uninhabitable and uninhabited. And then each of the days in creation found in the rest of Genesis chapter 1 correspond poetically to the phrase uninhabitable and uninhabited. So you see in days 1, 2, and 3, God creating the habitat. And then in days 4, 5, and 6, you actually see God putting people, putting things in the habitat. So, what is that word? Making it habitable, and then putting in habits in the habitat. Sorry. So God creates a place. And then we see in verse 26 of chapter 1, we see that he creates a people. He creates people to inhabit that. And so this is what we learn about us. This is really important. God said, let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, over the livestock, over the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created man in his own image, and the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. Okay, so we learn that we are created in the image of God. And all that means is that we're created to be like God and that we represent God here on earth. So we, humans, are given special dignity and worth by God. And in fact, in all of creation, we're the only thing, that we're the only beings that can say that we're created in God's image. And because of that, and this is incredibly important, it affects the way we should think about ethics, it affects the way that we should view each other. Because of that, we have incredible dignity. And to use Kant's phrase, we're literally priceless in God's economy. We are priceless beyond measuring value. And then he continues. So God creates a place, he creates a people, and then in the next verse, which is verse 28, he gives a purpose. And so here's sort of the first shot at what our purpose is as humans. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living creature that moves on the ground." So basically, you could summarize that in 2 points. What's our purpose? Well, it's twofold. One, to protect what we've been given. And then two, to extend to the end of the earth. I guess you might wonder, I used to wonder, like, why does God want us to be fruitful and multiply? I mean, does it just want us to multiply like rabbits for, I don't know, to fill the earth? Like, what does that mean? And actually, it's linked to the verses right before that we've been created in God's image. And so what God really wants to do is to fill the earth with the image of God, with the glory of God. And that's why he wants us to extend to the end of the earth. And furthermore, as his image bearer, we were created to be in relationship with God. Like I said, that we are relational at our core because God is relational at his core. And the Hebrew word, the Hebrews have a word for this, and the word is shalom. And in the Old Testament, shalom means a universal state of flourishing where we experience intimacy with God and harmony with each other. In other words, where we experience life the way it was supposed to be. And now that I'm reading philosophers, what also is interesting is philosophers, the ancient ones at least, discovered this by the dint of reason as well. In fact, Socrates and Aristotle and Plato all said that the purpose of life is, and this is the Greek word, eudaimonia. Our translation, the purpose of life is happiness. And happiness for the Greeks isn't what perhaps we think of happiness today. Today, when we say, you know, the purpose of life is to be happy, at least as I'm talking with my students, and my guess is you're not much different, happiness usually means something like this. An experience of sensuality and pleasure that is satisfying or something like that. That's the goal in life. But classically, happiness never meant that, actually. Classically, happiness is eudaimonia. It's this flourishing in light of our nature. And so the biblical picture just sort of fills that out a bit. Well, what does it mean to flourish in light of our nature? It means to experience intimacy with God and harmony with each other. And then also to have knowledge of God, the world, and self. Okay. So that is why we are created. This is our purpose, to flourish in light of our nature, intimacy with God, harmony with each other. Okay, so the next question I want to ask is, well, so we've got two stories, the atheistic, naturalistic story. We've got the theistic, specifically Christian story. Well, which one's true? I mean, truth is obviously important here. We don't just want to talk in the abstract here. So to bring focus to this question, let me put it another way. If man is so central to God's purpose on the theistic story, then why do we live on this marginal speck of real estate in this big and pretty seemingly indifferent universe? And that does seem to make some, that has some force to me. You know, why are we on this little speck in the middle of nowhere if we're so important to God? But here's the interesting thing. In recent years, physics and those who study this have given the most astounding answer to that question. And as it turns out, the vast size of the universe and the great age of our universe are actually indispensable for the possibility of life here on Earth, specifically human life. So in recent years, it seems as if we've discovered that the entire universe, with all of its laws, appear to be a conspiracy to create us, to create you. And actually, physicists have a name for this, and what they call this is the anthropic principle. In other words, that the universe is so finely tuned for life, and it's called this anthropic principle because it seems to be it's so finely tuned for human life. And what's interesting about that, this principle is widely accepted, and we could talk about all the different ways that it's finely tuned if you'd like in the Q&A time. But the anthropic principle itself is widely accepted. What is interesting is the attempts that are made by atheists to try to explain the anthropic principle. You know, why is the universe so finely tuned? And so here's actually, I want to just briefly run through the three prevalent ways to explain the fine-tuning of the universe. And there's basically two atheistic attempts to explain it, and then, of course, the theistic response as well. So here they are. The first one's called Lucky Us. The The second one is called the multiple universe explanation. And then the third one is called the designer explanation. The first two are an atheistic response. The last one is a theistic response. Okay, so I'll go through each of those briefly. Okay, first, the lucky us view. The lucky us view attributes the fine-tuning in the universe to incredible coincidence or luck. In fact, Steven Weinberg, one of the guys that I quoted earlier, he thinks that this is actually what happened. Actually, Richard Dawkins, if any of you have heard of him, he's sort of a popular atheistic writer. He wrote a book recently called The God Delusion. He also thinks this view, this sort of lucky us view. And they argue something like this. Here's kind of how the lucky us view goes. Look, since we're here, we know that the cosmic game of chance worked out in our favor, even though the odds are against it. That's it. That's really it. The very fact that we're having this conversation shows us that we rolled the dice, and even though it's really improbable, here we are. So, is that a good explanation? Well, I'd actually say, in response, this line of thinking is problematic, and actually it boils down to no real answer at all. And to try to motivate how that boils down to no real answer, let me share an example from a philosopher. His name is John Leslie. But this is what he says. He says, imagine a prisoner who was sentenced to death, and he's standing before a firing squad of 10 people who have guns, and so they load their guns, and they fire. And nobody hits them. So they reload their guns again, and they fire. Nobody hits them, and they continue to reload, fire, but he never gets hit. Now, could you imagine this man, after this, later, say he's approached by the warden, and the warden says something like this: well, I can't believe that they all missed. Clearly, there's some sort of conspiracy at work. Well, what if the prisoner laughed that off and said, well, there's no conspiracy. It's no big deal. Obviously, the marksman missed because if they hadn't missed, we wouldn't be having this conversation. Seems a bit odd, doesn't it? That doesn't seem like a good explanation. In fact, the it's no big deal response is not an explanation at all of why the prisoner is still alive. There's still this massive improbability that needs to be explained. Why did they miss you every time, 10 people? And that needs to be explained. And it's the same with our universe. It still needs to be explained. And the lucky us solution isn't gonna help. It's not gonna help that. In fact, recently, about a year ago, there's a philosopher named Anthony Flew. And he's, for the last 50 years, he's been a really prominent atheistic philosopher leader within that movement. And he just converted to a kind of Aristotelian theism because of the fine-tuning of the universe that the scientific evidence is showing us right now. And the reason why he did, and this is really telling, is because he said he needed to be consistent with his lifelong commitment to go where the evidence leads. And so the lucky us position isn't an explanation at all. Okay, so here's the second one. The second one, like I said, is the multiple universe response to the anthropic principle. And this view comes in a variety of forms, but basically it holds that there's an infinity of universes, and maybe they exist in sort of parallel universes. That's one way that's cashed out. The other way that it's cashed out is that there's an infinite sequence of oscillating universes where you have a big bang and then big bang and then a big crunch, and it just goes on like this forever. And that way you get an infinity of universes, and we just happen to be in the one where life was possible. So there's a couple things that can be said about this solution as well, but here's two. The first is this: there's simply no evidence for this view. There's no evidence for oscillating universes or for parallel universes that exist sort of right alongside us, but that are causally inaccessible to us. And actually, Weinberg, same guy, he admits this. He says they're very speculative ideas without any experimental support. So that's one problem. There's no empirical evidence for them. In fact, actually, by the very definition, there can't be any evidence for the one parallel universe one. We could talk about that if you'd like. But here's something that's even more problematic about that, is that really, the multiple universe solution doesn't answer this question. Well, why is there any universe instead of nothing? Why is there anything at all instead of nothing? And that needs to be explained. Even if there's an infinity of universes, well, why is there just one in the first place, let alone an infinity? And the only answer that the atheistic response or position can give at this point is really to say there is no explanation. It's just a brute fact that all these infinity of universes exist. But that's not really an answer, again. That's just a brute sort of assertion of fact. And I guess I would say at that point, and I have had conversations with people who take that route, and I would say at that point, what you're really manifesting is your dogmatism, is the atheist dogmatism, that any answer, even no answer, is better than the third alternative, right? Because the third alternative is that God did it, the designer explanation, that all of the fine-tuning is the result is best explained by an intelligent being who created it, who designed it. So I conclude that the theistic story is the theistic explanation, the designer explanation is the best explanation. And if that's the case, well, then the theistic story is true. And in fact, there's good reasons to think so because of science and because of the evidence that we get from science. And again, also, if that is the case, well then, you have been created in God's image, and therefore as the pinnacle of God's creation, we're endowed with great dignity. And again, to use Kant's phrase, that we're priceless, that you're not ordinary, that you're priceless. Okay, last section. Let me just say a couple thoughts on if this is the case, if Christianity is true, well, what does that mean for us? And so I want to just give sort of a distinctively Christian understanding of man here, given that theism in general is true. Now, as I've already stated, the Bible can be summarized. If you wanted to summarize the overarching story, it would be four words, right? Home, away, and then home again. And from Genesis 3, really to the end, it's a story of God pursuing us and wooing us and, in a sense, calling us to home, even though we've never been there ourselves, but calling us to experience shalom and to live life the way that God intended. And as Aaron mentioned earlier, though, he read that passage out of Romans, the wage of sin is death. Well, that's sort of the bad news, right? That we're alienated from God. We're away. And there's nothing that we can do to get back home, well, to get home really at all for the first time. There's nothing that we can do to become in relationship with God on our own efforts. That's the bad news, right? The good news, though, is that God is pursuing us. And he's pursuing us through our desires to be known and our desire to know. And, of course, you might have seen the, you know, one of the most famous verses in the Bible is John 3:16. But just listen to the heart of this. You've probably heard it before, but listen to God's heart. For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever should believe in him should not perish, but have eternal life. For God so loved the world that he's pursuing you, the crown of creation, so that you could, in a sense, come home, to come to know him for the first time. So this call home is a call first and foremost. I guess this is what I want you to understand. It's first and foremost to someone. It's a call to a person, namely God. But God doesn't want to stop there. And this is the distinctively Christian point that I want to share with you, that you've also been created to do something. Now, here's another passage. This is from the New Testament. This is Paul. He says this. He says, "For we are God's workmanship, created in Christ Jesus to do good works, which God prepared in advance for us to do." Actually, that word workmanship there, the Greek word, is literally masterpiece. That you are a masterpiece. That in this incredible world that God has created, you are literally a work of art, a masterpiece as God's pinnacle of all that he's created. Do you want to live a life of significance and meaning? Well, let me suggest to you that God did create you for a purpose. That first you've been called to someone, to enter into relationship with God, but then to know Jesus, and as his child, he has called you to fulfill a purpose, a destiny that is unique to you, that God has created for you to do. So tonight, there might be some in this room that are thinking that there's nothing special about you, that you're ordinary, or that you have nothing to offer. Let me tell you that that's not true, that you are created for God, by God, for relationship. And that you're created for a purpose that is uniquely yours, that you're created for significance. If you don't have a relationship with Jesus, I guess I just encourage you to talk to the friend who you came with, or come talk to me afterwards. And many people in this room would love to have a conversation with you and just begin to explore what that might mean and what that might look like. Let me end this time with a quote, actually from C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis, for the first 30 years of his life, was an atheist. And then one day, a little before he turned 30, he was confronted with the truth claims of Christianity, and he's confronted with a person, Jesus of Nazareth. And so he converted at about 30 years old to he became a Christian. And a couple years later, he was sort of thinking about, in light of Jesus, what is that? What is the implications for us as men? And so he wrote a little article called The Weight of Glory, and this is what he said, and I'll end with these words. He said, "There are no ordinary people. You have never talked to a mere mortal. Nations, cultures, arts, civilizations, these are mortal, and their life is to ours as the life of a gnat. But it is immortals whom we joke with, work with, marry, snub, and exploit. Immortal whores or everlasting splendors." Thank you.